Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a new school at ASU aims to incorporate technology into public health.
And the finalists for a literary prize judged by incarcerated people.
But first, state lawmakers are taking a late spring break, 2 weeks for the House, 3 for the Senate. During that time, GOP legislative leaders are hoping to focus on budget negotiations with the governor's office. They need to reach a deal by the end of the fiscal year on June 30th. With me now, hopefully from the beach, as he is every Monday during the legislative session to talk about what's to come this week at the state capitol, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Yes, I am in Havasu City with a bunch of drunken lawmakers. We've all decided that if, in fact, we're not going to have daily meetings, why are we sitting in Phoenix at 101 degrees?
Absolutely. So, do we have a sense of if the parties are anywhere close to an agreement? Like, the governor released her budget, as she is required to do in January. We've not really seen a plan from GOP legislators.
And that's been really interesting, because it used to be that once the governor released her budget, several days later, the Republicans, who have been in the majority in the legislature, would release their budget. And then you'd have a series of hearings. And that would allow people to kind of do fact-finding and determine, for example, does the Department of Economic Security need this amount of money? You know, what are the plans for the expansion of the Arizona healthcare cost containment system? Do we need money for certain new roads? All that has gone behind closed doors, which means that the leadership probably has an idea of what they'd like to spend it on, but they haven't shared it with the public. They may have shared a few details with the rank and file, but part of the other problem is we're not sure what the revenue numbers are going to be for next year. You know, we realize that the tariffs, as was reported this morning, are kind of a changing scenario here in terms of, is it 35% or 150% in terms of China? That clearly affects consumer spending. And as you know, half the state budget is based on sales tax. So we're kind of in a holding pattern here. But more of the point is, a lot of the Republican lawmakers don't want to go to the budget until they resolve this question of Prop 123. Now, remember, back 10 years ago, voters said, we want to take more money out of the state trust fund, about $350 million a year, and put it toward K-12 education.
Yeah.
That authorization expires later this year. Now, the money is going to keep coming out of the general fund, so there's not going to be any loss if they don't deal with it. But there are several plans out there to keep taking the money out. Republicans want to put it all to teacher salaries, maybe $4,000 a year. The governor has a plan to go ahead and do some teacher salaries, some support staff, some bus drivers, some school security, and other miscellaneous items. And then, of course, you've got the real complicating factor. The Republicans want to tie that, which has to go to the voters, to putting a right to vouchers into the state constitution.
Right.
So that needs to be the first thing resolved. And then maybe we'll get to the budget, and hopefully, as you point out, by the end of the fiscal year.
Well, so Howie, this raises the question, because the legislature does not need the governor's sign off to send a Prop 123 renewal to the ballot. I mean, one can debate whether it would be helpful to have everybody on board, since it barely passed 10 years ago. So does that indicate that Republicans are still sort of negotiating amongst themselves to get a package, a Prop 123 renewal, that they can all agree on before moving on to dealing with the Democratic governor?
Oh, I certainly think so, because as you point out, they can do it with 16 Republicans in the Senate and 31 Republicans in the House, and they've got a couple of extra members who, if they go south, don't screw it up. But I think there are also members who say, why would we put something on the ballot with a poison pill in it? And even if they agree with the idea of vouchers, why poke the bear? Vouchers are happening. Any Arizona child is entitled to a voucher of state funds. It starts about $7,400 a year. It goes up from there, depending on needs. Can get a voucher. The legality of vouchers has been upheld by not only the Arizona Supreme Court, but the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the argument by lawmakers is, well, yes, but a future legislature, future governor may be able to scale back vouchers. Mm-hmm. And the governor in her budget said that she wants to scale back so anybody earning over $200,000 a year doesn't get a voucher for their child. Is it worth, you know, going ahead and screwing up pay raises for teachers and additional money for teachers, you know, to accomplish what? A document in the Constitution that may or may not be needed?
So, Howie, I guess this kind of goes back to where we started. We don't, other than some of the things that the governor put in her budget proposal in January that the Republicans said they don't like, we don't really have a great sense of what the sticking points are or like what the points of agreement might be, do we?
No, we know that the governor, again, as we mentioned, wants to scale back vouchers. That's been pronounced a non-starter. There are some things that I think everyone realizes needs to be funded. For example, prison health care. The state has been paying millions and millions of dollars after a federal court said you're not taking care of inmates and it's become grossly negligent. You have the questions of the governor, for example, wanting $100 million for subsidized child care with mm-hmm. businesses.
Yeah.
Republicans may or may not support some of that because if it's a partnership with businesses, but they're interested in curbing other programs. I mean, by virtue of the fact that they've sent her bills to curb back on unemployment and food stamps and everything else. So a lot of it is going to become philosophical. And then there's always these tiny little things that come up. I need a traffic circle in my district, and I want $5 million for that, and I won't get on the budget until you show that. And those are the tiny little things that everyone wants. The governor, I'm sure, wants more money into the housing trust fund.
Yeah.
So this is going to be, let's just say, we're not getting out of here, by Memorial Day. I'm hoping we get out of here, you know, by the middle of June, because there's a lot to be decided.
Sure, sounds that way. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
On Friday, an Arizona federal judge granted a temporary injunction to delay the land transfer of Oak Flat between the U.S. Forest Service and the mining company Resolution Copper. It is the latest twist in a saga that pits significant industrial interests against significant indigenous land concerns. Joining us now to break this down is KJZZ's tribal natural resources reporter, Gabriel Pietrazio. Gabe, good morning.
Morning, Sam.
So, Gabe, you've actually been to Oak Flat. Can you give us just like a little description of what it looks like there?
For sure thing. Apaches refer to Oak Flat as Chichilbidagotil, which is sacred land spot that essentially Apaches have been going, Western Apaches have been going to forage oak acorns and use sacred springs there for a long time. Had conversations with Chairman Terry Rambler from the San Carlos Apache tribe and other communities that various Apache communities would move nomadically throughout the land in connection with the seasons and the cycles of nature to use the land for those purposes. And for ceremonial, spiritual, and cultural purposes, there are a number of burial sites there that were even acknowledged in the federal government study through the U.S. Forest Service as a part of the preparation needed to do the land transfer that you mentioned. And so there are a lot of oak trees. There's a lot of springs there that will be impacted, as the report says, should the mining project proceed as planned.
And what is Resolution Copper's interest here? What do they see in this territory?
For sure. They see a 1.4 billion metric ton copper ore body that is seen to be one of the largest undeveloped copper resources in the world. And it would take about 60 years for this mine to operate in full, 40 years of production, 10 years of construction, and 10 years of post-closure plans, essentially, to effectively extract that copper, which they say would be used for American domestic need for copper and help with the renewable energy transition, also compete with the national security interests and things of that nature as we try to wean off of foreign dependency of these minerals from places like China that we're in a trade war with.
So this transfer that was temporarily blocked by virtue of this injunction, was this a surprise? Did anybody see this coming?
I think it's a shock that it happened so quickly. The judge said that they would rule by no later than this Wednesday. So 2 days after the hearing was a bit shocking. Over the weekend, as I mentioned, Chairman Rambler said that he believes that this decision was actually a turning point in a 20-year fight to essentially protect Oak Flat. The judge in the ruling basically brought up that there were serious questions about the merits of the Supreme Court case. The company Resolution Copper told us that they don't see the merits changing as a result of the injunction being issued, and that this doesn't effectively change anything, but it just delays effectively the land transfer. We believe that the court and the nine justices may rule by no later than July, which is the end of their current Supreme Court session, before they go on recess. And between now and then, this injunction will take place until they decide on this case. To give you a bit of context, the court has already rescheduled this decision 13 times, which is in its own way somewhat unprecedented. During the oral arguments on Wednesday of last week, the plaintiffs argued that they couldn't find a cert that had been rescheduled 13 times and was denied after that. The defense didn't say otherwise, but they noted that there have been cases that have been reviewed a dozen times, 10 times, 11 times, but then were denied. And then in their own internal analysis by the U.S. government basically said that they found that about 62% of cases that had been rescheduled five times or more were denied subsequently. But this is pretty unprecedented in its own way, that it's been rescheduled 13 times since November, and we still don't have an answer on where they stand to hear this case or not.
Wow. So the injunction extends at least through the Supreme Court proceedings. What happens after that to the injunction?
So the injunction actually stays only until a day after the decision is made. Okay. So if the court will say, we'll take this on, it will still continue from our understanding. If the court rejects their petition, the injunction will remain in place until a day after that. Under the status quo right now, the Trump administration can sign the record of decision for the final environmental impact statement, which they have pledged to release within the 60-day time period. That could be as early as mid-June, when they could sign technically the land transfer, which would take lands which Oak Flat is on within the Tonto National Forest, federal public lands, and turn those into private property, essentially, that Resolution Copper would own. And that was kind of a big part of the sticking argument, is religious freedom case that they have enshrined rights under public federal law, whereas if this land transfer does go through, it could affect their right to practice their faith on those lands, because now they're private. It's private property, essentially.
All right. Well, we will have a lot to keep an eye on between now and July. That is KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio keeping us in the loop. Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll hear from an incarcerated person about having her perspective heard through judging books.
But first, ASU has named the first dean of its new School of Technology for Public Health. In a news release, the university says the school, quote, aims to create a new and rapidly evolving space for the integration of digital technology, data-driven decision-making, and a significant focus on local impact within public health. Jyoti Pottick will lead the new school. He comes to ASU from Cornell University and will officially start at the beginning of July. When I spoke with him recently, he started the conversation by talking about some of the public challenges Arizona is facing, including heat-related illnesses and death, substance abuse, and how that's impacted by the heat, as well as mental illness.
Now, you may ask the question, how is a new School of Technology and Public Health really going to address these challenges? Well, first of all, this new school is part of ASU Health, which does include a new medical school as well. And our objective here is to think about a much more comprehensive, new and bold approach for improving health outcomes in Arizona and beyond. Now, when you think about public health at its core, it's about prevention, right? So instead of treating diseases after they occur, public health focuses on reducing risk factors, promoting healthy behaviors, thinking about creating more supportive environments. And I think that's absolutely important. And I think our goal as part of the new School of Technology for Public Health is to really bridge that divide, right? Divide between individual health and public health, and really make public health more personal. So just to give, I think, one concrete example, let's say when it comes to heat-related illnesses and deaths, how could, for instance, satellite imagery and geographical information systems help us identify heat hotspots or at-risk populations? How can you really use emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence to help power simulations that can inform city planners to think about better heat mitigation policies or more designing more green infrastructure? How could likewise AI be used to facilitate mental health screening? So our new school, we really want to understand and develop these technologies and scale them. And then I think more importantly, work with our public health colleagues in local and state Department of Health to really deploy them across communities, especially in marginalized populations.
So you mentioned AI, and I wanted to ask you about that, because as I'm sure you know, there's been a lot of consternation about the role that AI is playing and could potentially play down the road in healthcare delivery and other aspects of healthcare. You mentioned a few areas where you think it might be helpful. I'm curious, like on balance, how do you see AI and what to you is the appropriate role of AI in healthcare?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Mark. I mean, I think it's well understood and well assumed that technologies such as AI are going to be hugely important for the field of medicine and certainly by that extension, public health. We are already seeing how AI-related tools are being incorporated in many different domains. So whether it's, again, apps for mental health support, smoking cessation, nutrition, they're all being used, these types of digital tools and behavioral health interventions. There has been quite a bit of progress again in geospatial mapping and how AI technologies could help us visualize health disparities and think about interventions. So I think we are perhaps at an early stage of how these tools and methods are being developed. And again, as part of the new school, we really want to train our students in AI, data science, cybersecurity, to develop tech-driven solutions which could help inform future technology-based outcomes and help improve our public health outcomes. Now, I think at the same time, it's important to understand that technology alone cannot fix all of these challenges.
How do you see this school sort of fitting into the healthcare ecosystem in Phoenix and the Valley? I mean, you obviously have the U of A Medical School, you have TGen and some of the other biotech firms that are going to be downtown as well. How does this operation sort of fit in with what's already here?
I think that's another fantastic question. I mean, I think this particular school, again, as part of a broader ASU health initiative, incorporates an important component, which is focused around public health. Right now, again, if you think about the field of public health, the parallel that I always think that public health is like the plumbing in your house, right? You, when it works, you barely notice, but when it breaks, everything falls apart. Mm. And so overall, as part of the ASU health strategy to really improve health outcomes across the state and beyond, this particular school fits an important role. Now, in the entire state as a whole, there's, of course, the University of Arizona has a robust public health school, and we anticipate multiple collaborations with UFA and NAU and other regional health systems. But where I think we will be able to distinguish ourselves as a new school will be along some of these dimensions. So the first dimension that really comes to my mind is around innovation. You know, we really want to think about how emerging technologies could be deployed in public health. Likewise, when it comes to the divide between public health and healthcare delivery system, as it turns out, data is often a huge barrier. And so we want to think about ways by which we can facilitate more tighter collaboration across these different sectors. Being in downtown Phoenix, I think we have a unique advantage to really build on these relationships, some of which already exist. and really think about a broader public health surveillance systems.
What is your sense of what the public perception is right now of public health? It just seems like maybe the field took a bit of a hit during COVID. I'm curious what your sense is of this.
Yeah. I think certainly during the pandemic, I would say maybe the peak of the pandemic and beyond, there was a lot of energy behind public health. The public was aware of public health. But again, going back to my plumbing analogy, public health by far remains invisible, right? And then you don't always hear about how food inspections are being done. You don't always hear about how wastewater surveillance is being done to identify certain viruses or bacteria in your systems. And so public health by far, I think, still works in the background and remains invisible. And I think that is an important part that we really want to focus in our school, is that public health research must be sensitive to the community needs, right? So listen first and then act. And given the era we are with unprecedented misinformation, disinformation, or perhaps to some degree even outright anti-science aggression, I think developing mechanisms about effective communication of public health and public health technology becomes very important.
Jyoti Patik is the inaugural dean for the School of Technology for Public Health at ASU.
The presidents of Ukraine and Russia are back in the spotlight this week after a busy weekend of diplomatic maneuvering. Joining us now with the latest on the situation, as well as some other updates from around the globe, is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin. Jonathan, there is potentially the prospect of direct peace talks between Ukraine and Russia on Thursday. How did we get to this point?
Well, it's been quite a weekend of diplomacy with respect to Ukraine. On Saturday, France's President Emmanuel Macron, Germany's new Chancellor Friedrich Merz, Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk, and Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer all travelled to Ukraine for a summit with President Volodymyr Zelensky. There's quite a striking picture of them bringing US President Donald Trump into their meeting for a phone call as well. Ostensibly, the purpose of the get-together was to ratchet up the pressure on Russia to move towards announcing a 30-day ceasefire that they wanted to see come into effect today to leave room for peace negotiations to take place. That was set against the backdrop of a threat of tightening sanctions on Russia. So the ball was firmly in Vladimir Putin's court on Saturday, and that evening he issued his response. In a late-night television address at 2 a.m. local time, he proposed direct talks between Russia and Ukraine in Turkey, starting this coming Thursday. But crucially, there was no mention of an immediate ceasefire, only the prospect of a truce following talks. President Zelensky responded by indicating it was a, quote, positive sign that Russia was considering ending the war, and said Ukraine was ready to meet Russia, but indicated he wanted a ceasefire first in order for that to occur. Yesterday, Donald Trump then weighed in on his social media platform, saying Ukraine should agree to talks immediately. He added, quote, I'm starting to doubt that Ukraine will make a deal with Putin. Shortly after that, Volodymyr Zelensky upped the ante again by indicating that he would be willing to meet Vladimir Putin personally in Istanbul on Thursday.
So what chance is there of a peace deal being agreed to if the two sides do actually get together on Thursday?
Well, one key question is whether Vladimir Putin actually wants peace. He claims to, but it's a peace only on Russia's terms. It would seem Moscow suspects it has little gain from a 30-day ceasefire, particularly since the Russians feel they have the initiative on the battlefield. At the same time, Russia doesn't want to be seen as an obstacle to peace. It wants to maintain a good relationship with the Trump administration, which could ultimately lead to sanctions relief from the United States and the prospect of economic deals in the wake of that. So by proposing these talks, he signals to Donald Trump, in effect, that he is a man of peace. And Donald Trump's response would seem to indicate that he takes that somewhat at face value. Now, it may be that Vladimir Putin's offer of talks is in fact aimed at driving a wedge between the United States and Ukraine's European allies. And if that's the case, I'd say it seems to some extent to be working. Meanwhile, if the peace talks do actually happen, I think most observers believe they're unlikely to actually lead to a lasting peace.
Well, a very significant week in terms of developments there, Jonathan. Let's pivot now. The second and deciding round of Romania's presidential election is this coming Sunday. And there is some controversy in the background to this election.
Well, that's right. Last November, the first round of Romania's presidential election was held, and an independent far-right candidate named Calin Georgescu stunned the country by unexpectedly winning the vote. But then a few days later, intelligence documents were declassified, suggesting Georgescu had benefited from a mass influence operation conducted from abroad to interfere with the result of the vote. Hundreds of TikTok accounts are alleged to have been set up by Russia to back him, and there's no doubt he was a popular figure on social media. But Romania's constitutional court then annulled the result of the first round of the election just a few days before the second round was due to take place, ordering the elections to be rerun from scratch at a later date. And the new first round took place 8 days ago. Calin Georgescu responded to the court ruling by arguing the country's democracy was, quote, under attack, and describing the verdict as a formalized coup d'etat. He indicated at the time that he would seek to run again for president, but he was blocked from doing so. And back in March, the constitutional court upheld that ruling in a unanimous decision.
So who is now in the running for the presidential election this weekend?
Well, the first round was won by a right-wing nationalist candidate, George Simeon, who is against providing military support to Ukraine and is sceptical about the European Union. He secured almost 41% of the vote and will face a runoff on Sunday against the Liberal mayor of Bucharest, Nicu Sordan, who picked up a little over 20% of first-round votes. So George Simeon is the strong favourite to win this weekend and is a close ally of Calin Georgescu. Now, Romania plays a significant role with respect to Ukraine, so the election's being closely watched among the country's allies. Last September, Romania gave one of its two Patriot air defense systems to Ukraine, and 70% of Ukraine's grain exports traveled down the Black Sea coast in 2023 through Romanian territorial waters. Romania also trains Ukrainian pilots to fly F-16s. Analysts reckon that a Simeon victory in the presidential election could put much of that support in jeopardy, though it's worth noting that Mr. Simeon denies that he is pro-Russian.
All right. Well, finally this week, Jonathan, in a different vein, tomorrow we will hear the verdict in a Paris court of the actor Gerard Depardieu's recent trial. Remind us what he's been charged with.
He stands accused of sexually abusing two women during a film shoot in 2021. The film is called Les Volets Verts, or The Green Shutters, and is about an aging actor coming to terms with his declining powers. Now, prosecutors allege that he made explicit sexual remarks to and then aggressively groped two members of the production team. If convicted, Gerard Depardieu could face 5 years in jail and a fine of up to €75,000. Now, the court case was held in Paris back in March, and at the time, several dozen protesters were outside the courthouse, with many holding up placards in support of victims of sexual assault and chanting feminist slogans.
And how did the court case play out at that time?
Well, Gerard Depardieu indicated that he acts in a world that is no longer his own. He said, "I'm not very much at ease with this new society," adding, "I think my time is done." But he denied being a sexual abuser. The first plaintiff, a set director, told the court that Depardieu had caught her between his legs, held her by the hips, and told her obscenities. The second plaintiff, an assistant director, said he had put his hand on her buttock on two occasions, on a third, her breast. In his defense, he argued that he may have touched the women accidentally or to keep his balance, but that there was never any sexual intent. And despite the allegations against him, Gerard Depardieu has received strong messages of support from some members of France's artistic community. In a letter published in 2023, a group of more than 50 actors, directors and producers, including Charlotte Rampling and Carla Bruni, said accusations against Depardieu were, quote, an attack on art itself. But we'll find out what the court makes of it all when its ruling emerges tomorrow.
Well, lots to pay attention to, as always, this week. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin, keeping us in the loop, as always. Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. The Arizona Corporation Commission says it'll look into what led APS to disconnect the power of a customer last May. The 82-year-old woman died, with the medical examiner ruling heat stress contributed to her death. Once Kate Corman's death came to light, it led to a back and forth on social media between one of her sons and a member of the Utility Regulating Corporation Commission. The commissioner later apologized for his comments. With me to talk about the situation and what changes could be made to try to prevent this from happening again are Lori Roberts, columnist for the Arizona Republic, who wrote about this, and Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor at the Republic. And Lori, let me start with you. Can you narrow down what stands out to you about this particular episode?
I think what stands out to me are two things. Number one, it took fully a year for the Corporation Commission to decide to review this case, recognizing that the Corporation Commission's job is to regulate utilities, I'm wondering why it took a year and public pressure to get them to look into that. They say, well, it's because the Sun's finally launched an inquiry with us. Well, it shouldn't take that. A woman died because her air conditioning was turned off on a 99 degree day. An elderly woman living alone died as a result of this. And the other thing that stands out to me is Commissioner, Vice Chairman, exactly, Nick Myers, who, when this came out, literally sprang to APS's defense. He blamed the Suns. You should have been there for your mother. He said APS went above and beyond what they needed to do. And my favorite was, and this is a direct quote, "I don't feel it's a utility's responsibility to keep everyone alive," unquote.
Well, so Elvia, I'm curious what stands out to you, because this is unfortunately not the first time we have read the story of somebody having their power turned off on a hot day and not surviving that situation. So is there something about this particular incident that stands out to you?
Well, the fact that it took a whole year for APS to review it only tells me that there may be many other cases that we still don't know. We know about this one because someone decided to report it and the public made a big deal out of it. But imagine a year went by. Who knows how many more have died that we just don't know about it. And, you know, that's a very important question about what's the responsibility of the utilities. And that's the bottom line here. You know, in Arizona, we have a monopoly, or what I call that, at least in Metro Phoenix, we only have two companies, APS and Salt River Project, that provide this kind of services. So there should be some sort of regulation, some sort of responsibility for the privilege of having a monopoly, depending on the area that they are serving. And so, yes, of course, you know, I even columnist Phil Boas, who's in my team, he came to the defense of the utilities, essentially questioning, well, what are they're not responsible. They're not charities. They are for profit. They are businesses. Yes, of course, all of that is true. They're not charities. They are business. In fact, I think even Lori mentioned it, wrote about it. APS made $500 million or so in profit. So $500 that this person owed was not going to make a difference in terms of the bottom line.
Yeah, let me pick up there what she said. They're not a charity. In fact, they made $608 million in profit in 2024. That's up from $501 million the year before. So they're doing pretty well with this monopoly, with this gift of being able to have a captive audience, a captive customer base. And with that comes responsibility. I don't care what Commissioner Myers says. There is indeed a responsibility. And I don't think anybody's suggesting that, you know, people should just be able to quit paying their electric bill and continue on. But before you go and cut someone off, especially a longtime customer like this, I think that you have a responsibility to speak with them, to make sure that there's not something going on here. And yes, they're not social workers, but they're making a lot of money off of us. And I think with that comes responsibility.
Well, so Lori, let me ask you about that, because APS has said that they reached out to Ms. Corman a number of times. They emailed her. They say they left a hanger on their door, now on her door. Now, the family says they didn't find any evidence of anything on the door when they came to their mom's house. Her son said that, and that the phone call went to an old number. The emails were just sitting in her inbox. I'm wondering, like, if this is more a situation where, like, the process just needs to be changed. Like, there needs to be, as you reference, some kind of human-to-human interaction. Like, there needs to be maybe a responsibility to actually physically talk to somebody.
I think that's exactly it. The problem here was one of communication. The son has said that her mother was on, that his mother was on auto pay, which is where they just automatically take the money out every month out of your account, but that something went wrong and in January it quit working. So APS starts sending her notes via email, because her billing is via email, but they don't put, according, again, this is all according to the son, they don't put into the guide where you would see it, you know, warning, please open this overdue bill or anything like that. And no bells or whistles going off. So she apparently never opened any of these emails. Eventually, they call her. It's an old number. So she, again, still has no idea of what's going on here. They supposedly leave a door hanger on her door, which her sons and neighbors say they never saw, never found. But if you're going to go to the trouble of putting a door hanger on her door saying you were overdue, you better contact us, why not knock on that door?
Elvia, do you have any measure of optimism that once the Corporation Commission undertakes this review of this case, that maybe the processes can change and maybe, you know, the utilities can be encouraged or maybe just on their own start to really focus on trying to do what they need to do to communicate with their customers and make sure that, you know, something like this doesn't happen again?
I hope so, but I'm not going to hold my breath knowing APS. Honestly, you know, $500 that she owed in bills, just a Lori side, no one expects APS to just forget about people not paying their bills. But $500 is, you know, should be something that they should take as say the cost of doing business, meaning $500 is not going to bankrupt APS or any utility companies. It should be part of, again, the cost of doing business, the privilege of having a monopoly. So I'm not holding my breath without a public outcry and without public pressure.
Lori, APS is obviously a very large company, a very large utility. I wonder, you know, none of us are on the inside of this company, but I wonder, like, how easy or difficult can you imagine it might be to change the process like this and really make a point to communicate with customers in a way that will maybe be a little more meaningful? Because it seems as though, as we've talked about, APS did reach out to this particular customer a number of times. It just seems like those methods of communication weren't all that effective.
No, they weren't all that effective, but I've also got to say right here that, and yes, I don't think it should be that difficult. I don't know how many customers, I think I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but last May they disconnected a little over 2,000 people. So I don't recognize you don't have an army of people that can go and knock on doors. I think that you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. But I think there's one thing that they can do, and number one is make sure that your customers know the importance of having an updated phone number and put in, if you're sending stuff to people in a email, make sure that it's in the contact line, you know, with blinking red lights, overdue notice, so that somebody will see it. I don't know, you probably like me, you get a bazillion emails a day and I don't open half of them. So that would be helpful. The other thing that would be helpful is they have a program that allows family members to be notified if one of their elderly customers is in trouble. And I think that's a great program, but I think that they need to publicize it a little bit more and make sure, especially for their elderly customers, that they know about this.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Lori Roberts, columnist for the Arizona Republic, Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Republic. Thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
You bet.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. A few weeks ago, the Freedom Reads Literary Competition announced the shortlist for their 2025 prize. It's the second year of the competition, which claims to be the first of its kind to be judged exclusively by incarcerated people. The four finalists were announced by the Freedom Reads Selection Committee, and I recently spoke to one of the members of that committee, Crystal Capilla. Capilla, who now goes by the name Alex, is currently serving time at a prison in Perryville. She is 10 years into a decades-long sentence for her role in a violent robbery that left two people dead. And when we spoke, I asked her what appealed to her about serving as a judge for this competition.
To be honest with you, having our point of view valued as a person that's incarcerated is completely mind-blowing to me. It was one of the appeals that had drawn me into the program in the first place, to actually know that our voices would be heard more than just in prison, out there publicly as well. It was very moving, and it was honestly very different. Like, we got to actually judge something other than being judged, if that makes any sense.
That does make sense. That does make sense. You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm imagining that when you're incarcerated, there's probably a lot of people who are not incarcerated who have just totally fantastical ideas about what life in prison is like. And it strikes me as rather humanizing to present this version of life in prison where it's like, yeah, we do what you do. We sit and read books and think about them.
Yeah, and we talk about them. That was even more mind-blowing when we actually got to speak about the books that we read together as a group. It was crazy. Like, it felt like we were almost not incarcerated for a moment.
Wow. What about it felt like you were not incarcerated? Can you say more about that?
I would say the human interaction without thinking about the fact that we were in prison talking about books. It was kind of like an escape because books are my escape from here. I read a lot of books. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it was just something that drew us together and kind of elevated our, like, the mindset that we were in, even though we were still in prison. It kind of took us out to, like, the free world where we were talking about books, like if we were actually at a normal book club.
So were you a big reader before you got to prison, or was reading something that you found once you were there?
I actually liked reading books out there. I own all the Harry Potter series and the Twilight series.
Cool.
Like, I used to read books a lot very out there.
Uh-huh.
So coming into prison, finding people that have never read books before, that have never been interested in them. And like one of my best friends actually didn't like books, but then she started reading and she actually like likes them a lot now. So that's something that we have in common.
Do you feel like your relationship to the books, it sounds like you're a big fiction reader. Did your relationship to reading change in prison versus the role that it played in your life outside of prison?
Honestly, yes. So most of the books that I like reading now are based either like on the real person. I like knowing about like their real stories. I don't really like reading like fiction anymore. I like nonfiction.
Uh-huh. Anything in particular that you've read in narrative nonfiction recently that you'd recommend? I'm a big narrative nonfiction reader myself.
I read the one that I have from the book club, the Madness of a Woman, I think.
Yes.
I can't remember the title.
Yes, Astrid Romer, On a Woman's Madness.
Yes, On a Woman's Madness, yes. I'm actually stuck between reading that one again, and then there's another one that my friend wants me to read, but I don't remember the title of it.
Uh-huh.
It's an autobiography by some lady. I don't remember, but she was kidnapped. And then it was just like, it's like a based on a true story type of movie.
Wow.
Book.
Yeah. So that's a good segue to talking about your top four here. Tell me about On a Woman's Madness. What did you like about it?
I just liked that it was raw and real, and it didn't like, it wasn't like one of those fairy tale movies where like everything has glitter and glam and everything's going to turn out the way you expect. It's about basically this one main character, basically the things that she went through in life, the trauma, the ups, the downs, the things that have happened to her, the abuse, like, and it kind of reminds me a lot about the women that are here, actually.
Wow. Let's talk about some of the other ones on the list. You've also listed Blackouts by Justin Torres.
That book, The Blackouts by Justin Torres, was an autobiography of a Black man that was actually gay. I wasn't brought up. I wasn't allowed to like be thinking about like, oh, guys can be with guys or girls can be with girls. Like very culture aspect as Mexican, like that wasn't a thing back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like more common, like everybody can be anything that they want to be now. And so the book kind of touches on like not being able to share those things with other people and then finally finding someone to share that history with was like completely different. It was just like a new world, like something that hadn't been discovered yet.
Yeah. Well, and if I'm hearing you right, for you, it was maybe a little bit of an exposure to a world that you...
I knew nothing about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always the best when a book can do that.
It educates you. It keeps you, it doesn't keep you from being in the dark. It brings things to light that you've never would have even thought about or been exposed to because you were never around it. And it's actually was very educational for me to read it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's see, there's two other books here. There's Chain Gang All-Stars. Tell us about Chain Gang All-Stars.
that was my favorite book because I'm incarcerated. Like, the book is basically kind of like, what is that one TV show called? The one where they kill, The Purge? That's kind of what that yeah. book reminds me of.
Oh, God.
In prison.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it was showing like, oh, you mess up so many times. Oh, you're going to have to go to this place where you have to fight for your life in order to be able to get out. And it was just crazy because, like, sometimes it feels like that when you're in here. But it's like not like you're physically fighting, but you're, like, mentally fighting all these things to make sure that you don't go down backwards.
Yeah. And then last one would be This Other Eden. Tell us about that book.
This Other Eden is a book about heaven, basically, and it was telling you the history of Jesus and God and, like, everything. It was just reading you all these things. And I'm a very spiritual person, so of course that book was going to be in my top four.
Would you say this book changed your dynamic around spirituality, or?
It was basically confirming everything that I believe.
Yeah, that's another wonderful thing that a really good book can do, right? Is, I mean, sometimes it exposes you to a new perspective that you haven't considered, and sometimes it upholds beliefs that you already have and shows
and
you
stronger.
Yeah. Well, last question for you, Alex. You have said that you're, I know you're a mom and that you're determined not to let your time being incarcerated define you. That's something I read somewhere that you had said in another interview. How does this project, the Freedom Reads project, play into that for you?
It gives me something to do as in a positive way. It allows me to create good friendships with people that are like-minded, that want better for themselves. It allows us to reach beyond this place, reach beyond these bars, and actually, like, get to know people as humans, not as people as who they were, as their cases, as their mistakes. Just because I'm incarcerated doesn't mean I'm not human.
Well, Alex Capilla is a member of the judging committee for the Inside Literary Prize. Alex, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.